Tomorrow, I turn 65 years old, which is, I didn't think about it too much until I had all these old friends of mine wanting to somehow acknowledge it. And the Social Security and Medicare people seem to be very interested in it as well. And it is, in a strange way, a demarcation, and I won't call it a turning point, but it is a moment of acknowledgement. It's a moment in which certainly the age 70 looms larger than it ever has. And for most people, I think, end-of-life issues suddenly rise or begin to rise into consciousness. But unlike most people, I was born old. I was like 80 years old when I was 3. And I always had a sense of myself as somebody very aware of end-of-life from the very beginning of life, which is not a great way to go through it. It can cause a lot of anxiety, tension, and depression. As a kid, I never understood why everybody in the world wasn't talking about the fact that they died. I mean, it seemed to me like it was the one inevitable thing, and nobody addressed it. Everybody was just having, you know, let's have a good time, let's make a lot of money or whatever you're going to do and have a great life, and it all seemed fine, but it all seemed conditioned by the fact that you're not going to have it for very long. You know, whatever you do, whatever you get is very temporary. And the way people were so serious about it, I kept going, don't they get it? And in a way, of course, we don't get it. It's very hard for us to get that life has a limited duration, and that at some point, if you're lucky, you get old. And it's a very extraordinary experience watching age occur, watching the body, if you will, begin its decomposition, and everything that goes along with that, including your mind. And so you watch yourself getting older, you watch all the people around you getting older. It becomes a real major topic of discussion, because it's kind of you greet it with a kind of an amazement, like, how did this happen? Like, we never expected it, which is absurd, of course, because it happens, and it happens to everyone. And I remember as a kid sitting around looking at what I called Hadassah women, my mother's old friends, you know, all white-haired and very wrinkled and, you know, overflowing in every direction. And I kept going, how did that happen? How did these women become this? They were cute girls, you know, they were sweet. And it started at my 30th high school reunion. I watched that process, and in fact, actually, it was rather interesting. At the 30th reunion, the women looked pretty good. The men were totally unrecognizable. Absolutely. But by the 40th, and I didn't have the interest or even the courage, I suppose, to go to it, I got videos of it, and I couldn't recognize anybody. It had happened. The thing that happens, happened. And it was devastating to look at, because we're so affixed in our culture on beauty, on youth, on sustaining and creating a kind of permanent culture of looking and being young, which is, of course, totally impossible. So people go out and do all these absurd things to themselves to create the illusion and the image of youth. And you know, I haven't known too many people who have done that. My mother never did it, but she used to walk around all the time trying to pull the crow's eyes out of her eyebrows and out of her side of her face, and saying, "What would it be like if I just had a little facelift this way or a little facelift that way?" And I begged her not to, because I loved her face. I loved her aging face. And I have a friend, a former TV star, who did get a facelift, and I went over to see her shortly afterward, and she was in a state of panic. She couldn't feel her old face. It felt tight. It wasn't her. And luckily, I couldn't recognize too much of what had changed in her, but I could feel her discomfort at her battle to fight the inevitable. It was just so, it was a strange, discomforting thing. It was not natural. And of course, you look at people who have had one or many more facelifts, and what happens is the body ages around them. So that where you pull these things out, other things come that are very, very unnatural, and you are fighting a battle for the rest of your life to look like something that isn't human. And what is human is aging. What is human is this extraordinary process. And last night I sat, last two nights I had dinner with these old friends. In fact, it was four of us who were college roommates in our first year of college. And two of the friends go back to high school and one to elementary school. And we sat around together in a state of such sweet pleasure, such joy of having been through the wars, if you will, having lived our lives and having come back to tell our tales to each other, our adventures. There's something remarkable about living long enough to be able to talk about what you've learned, what you felt, what you saw. And if is the case with many people, you kind of go off on your own directions and then you come back to bring back your stories. And the narratives are all we have on some level. And we've all had great stories and we've all learned great lessons through our stories. And I think I've talked about this before, but one of the fascinating things you discover is how little you've changed from when you were sitting in your college dorm, or in this case we had an apartment. You're sitting in your apartment talking about stuff, and what happens is you discover that you talked about dreams that are now 40, 50 years later, realized and unrealized, completed and uncompleted. But the journey to all of that has sort of leveled out. And what's really interesting is that those of us who've had, you know, success, and those who've had less success, or those of us who've attained things we wanted and those who didn't, still arrive at a funny, interesting sameness of happiness. Getting what you want and not getting what you want don't seem to change the possibility for being happy. Because in the end, you both have to accept what you've had or what you haven't had. And it's the acceptance of that that brings the leveling of the playing field. And you just find out that life has been this story to try to do, to get, to have, to own, to all of that stuff, to some degree of achievement or not. But in the end, you're still sitting there as if you're in your dorm talking about the adventure and describing it and realizing that there's enormous variable in life for everybody. Every adventure is its own thing. But in the end, telling the tale is what it's about. Sharing the experience, being with one another, being in the same space, and acknowledging what it means to have traveled the road of life. The other thing that happens at this moment is that you share the deep realization that the end is in sight. It's a powerful, powerful awareness that you are starting to fall apart and what that means. And how is it even possible to be happy in that condition? It's a really strange thing. When you're young, you can't imagine that decomposition could in any way be a positive. And it's not completely positive. As they say, you know, in all the cliches, you know, old age is not for wusses. You know, it's old age is a tough, tough experience. And it is a toughness that you gain from having lived your life. It's an ability that you get as you get older, having been around the sun so many times. You begin to get the patterns, you begin to see how it works, and you begin to become, perhaps if you're lucky, wise. Wisdom is acquired through the observation of pattern. And there are people who are very observant and people who are not. And I must say, our current culture is not an observant culture. Our current culture is trying endlessly to deny the process. But the real process is extraordinary. And what happens is you start to observe your own dissolution as a liberation. It frees you from so much stuff that you carry around as a younger person. You start to end the need for acquisition. You start to need the end for distraction. You start to end the need for distraction. You start to give up vanity to some degree. Some people, not everybody. All the things that you have been defining your life and what you need to do start to just relax out of the picture, and you just become who you are. You just finally settle in. This is it, guys, for better or for worse. And it's not a bad thing. There's something about it that is really quite wonderful if you can allow yourself to get there. It's not an automatic. Again, it is more automatic in ancient time, in ancient cultures where the aging process was understood. In our culture, where you can fight it and where people are encouraged to fight it and even fight death, you know, with every possible machinery and medical marvel available to us, we never get, or many of us never get to the point of relaxing into the truth of your own being and of your own dissolution. And that's a very hard thing for people, because if you're fighting all the way to the end, you're fighting beyond the end. You'll never come to the wisdom of life. Never. The only way to arrive at that wisdom is this kind of acceptance. And in a funny way, we need the meditative life, the life that each of you are pursuing, in order to counteract the pull of the culture away from what is natural. The meditative life is the only way back to natural. The word only may be wrong, but it is certainly a very real way back to living as mankind was meant to live, which is to understand there are cyclical patterns to our lives, and they all end with the ultimate dissolution of life. And if you really can go deep, deep into yourself and make peace with that, that dissolution is not a bad thing. We are meant to, and we are biologically programmed to hold on to life and fight for life with everything in us. Everybody is. But that hunger to hold on, it's hard to understand this, but it starts to change as you get older. I watch people, relatives in their 80s and 90s, who are what they would call ready to go. Just ready. Because the thing that drives us through life, ambition, the desire to have families, to reproduce, all of those things that we seem to want, to be creative, all of those urges start to transform as you get older. They really transform, and they begin to lessen their hold on you. And after a while, very little has a hold on you. And what you do, you get this image usually of old people from long ago sitting on the rocking chair, working in the garden, taking little walks, staring at the rose bush for 2 hours, you know, and you look at them and like, oh God, how sad, you know, what a terrible thing, when it's exactly the opposite. It's exactly the opposite. It's a completely beautiful thing. And you can't understand how beautiful it is until age happens. And as all these other things fall away, if you can be gracious about it, which really involves what Rudy called letting go or surrender, if you can really do that, you can arrive at a place of peace and acceptance. And so, in the end, slipping out of your old jacket of life is not hard. You just take it off. You just put it aside. And of course, there are still little fragments of attachment to the what's called the narrative. You know, what will happen next? And it's, at that point, it's not about what will happen next in your life, because there isn't a next, which is probably the great lesson. There's no next. What will happen next is nothing. Or well, we don't know, but the idea of what will happen next for most people as they get old ceases to be about them, but about other, about their children if they have children, or grandchildren if they have grandchildren, or about, you know, what will happen on the news, you know, who will be elected president, you know, what movie will open next month that I won't be around to see. You know, those are the last fragments of attachment to the world, curiosity, really. But as you start to really, really free yourself, you just let go of that, and you know it's in good hands, and you just allow, and you slip into, and that's the big mystery for everybody. What do you slip into? Well, that mystery is lessened as a mystery if you've sat quietly in meditation long enough, because the space you are slipping into begins to announce itself long before you get there. And it is, I've talked about this so often in class, it's the infinite, endless, and eternal awareness of being. I know most people, in some sense, expect to kind of black out at the end of life, and they expect blackout to be an infinite state. Some people expect there to be heaven and hell and all of those issues. And blackout may occur, and heaven and hell may temporarily occur, as the mind finally truly disengages from its attachments and its fears. But then as that winds down, what's left is just awareness. And that awareness has been there from the beginning and will be there forever. Now, you can believe me or not believe me, doesn't matter. But that awareness is familiar in the most unbelievable way, because you have always known it. You have always been aware of it, or been aware, period. Being aware of being aware is the subtle practice of meditation. And the final stages of dissolution leave you nothing but awareness, nothing but. But the natural journey into that is the journey that we are on. We are on the journey into experience, storytelling, adventure, love, pain, joy, misery, all of that. And trust me, you wouldn't give up any of that if you understood how precious every part of it is. You go on the journey, you report to your friends what that journey has been, you report to yourself hourly, daily, minute to minute sometimes about that journey, and then at the very end, the journey is finished. And people, if you're lucky, acknowledged having known you on your journey, having been around for that journey, because it's such a precious thing. It's such an amazing thing to know people who've shared your time and space, who've gone on that ride with you. And when they leave you, there is an emptiness, there is something gone from you, which is much more painful, in a way, than for the person who's gone. Your own loss is the beginning of a recognition of dissolution, of age, of process, of the ride. And it's all exquisitely beautiful, exquisitely poignant, and we're lucky to have it. I think I gave a talk not unlike this when I turned 60, and I'll probably give another one when I turn 70, if I do turn 70 or 80 or whatever it is. And I absolutely am grateful to to have each one of these talks. I happen to love this life and love the fact that I'm here and love being in a way that's increasing, actually. I struggled with it a lot when I was younger because there were so many conflicts and tensions, and some of those residues are still there. They do they do have a way of holding on, but the ultimate joy of life is not achieved, it is not attained, it is not worked for. The ultimate joy of life is living life. Period. So I encourage you all to enjoy your life and know that I'm reporting from the front lines of 65, that it's still good and it's still worthy, and in a sense it gets both better and more complicated in terms of it's more complicated because you got a lot to deal with. That's really big stuff, but it's great stuff. It's the stuff of letting go. Question?
Yeah, the more I hang out with my parents, the more I feel that there's not much time left, even though, you know, they're only, like, my dad's 77, my mom's 72. But she's starting to fall apart a little, you know. He's not, but she is. And, you know, they could have another 20 years, who knows, 25 years. But I feel this sort of sadness when I'm with them.
This, I mean, the sadness, loss is a huge part of human experience. The good thing about that sadness that you're feeling is if you use it well, you will appreciate them infinitely more in the time that you have them, because it doesn't last long, and it can end in ways that are very unexpected and quick, and I've always felt this, and I've lived my life accordingly, which is, live, you know, the cliche, live your life as though it's every day is the last. But that really means to me, say everything you need to say to the people you need to say it to, and make sure it's known. If you love them, make sure you know that they know that. And make sure that you've finished all the business you have with people now, and keep it that way. Don't let things go undone or unsaid. It frees you. It really frees you. I mean, I have a guy who for a while became, last year, a kind of an enemy. I don't have many enemies in my life. And he went through a terrible, terrible experience in the last month. And I had the opportunity to gloat about it. But instead I wrote him a kind of a really loving note. And it felt so right to do that. The end that I wanted was not the gloat, but was the connection and the human expression of connection. And so it was an opportunity where I could have left something undone and felt righteous about it and good about it, or I could be the human being and go, I'm sorry your journey created so much pain for you. I'm telling you, closing that chapter meant everything. I had a lawyer many years ago that when I left him, he could not forgive me at all. And he ended it so angrily that I couldn't communicate with him. And then I heard, luckily, that he was dying. And I'd always wanted to write him some letter. And so I said, this is the moment. And I wrote the letter. And he got it 3 days before he died. His wife called me and wrote back to me and said he had cried. He had been so grateful for the final closure that I could have missed had I not taken that moment and done it. I'm not trying to extol myself. I'm trying to tell you, finding closure with everything in your life day by day by day by day frees you. So there's no sticking points in your mind that you're going to come back to with regret and with the inability to truly let go. Because what holds people back is the undone, the unsaid, the unexpressed. And you just need to do it. You need to live your life completely now and make peace with everything in it as you go along. It's really important. And I'm talking about the Christian idea of love thy enemy. you know, all of that. It's essential.
I have a lot of trouble thinking about death, because I'm really afraid of how I might die, especially it would be great if I become old, and I have plenty of time to, make whatever amends I need to make. But I'm afraid that I'm going to die a very painful, violent death, and I don't know why. I think about it a lot, and I feel like it's amazing that you're talking about it today, because it was something that's really been bothering me. And like, what's my problem? Why am I, thinking about this kind of stuff all the time? I'm so scared.
Well, I mean, the fear of death is not uncommon in the human experience. I mean, it's there, and then it's buried by most people. Not today, I won't look at it. But of course, it could be today, and it could be in 2 minutes. We live in an earthquake zone. It could be anything can happen. That's why you make peace with it to the degree that you can now. You face it. You live in the moment with the possibility of it. The Tibetans used to go meditate, in the graveyards. And, the whole idea of acknowledging it, not to be morose and not to be grotesque, but to just say, this does have an end. And it has an end that can come at any moment in your existence. So, to the best of your ability, live in the present. And know that that moment that you're talking about, whether it be violent and painful or whatever, will be in the moment. And then it's learning how to deal with the moment. And how do you deal with the moment? You accept it. You embrace it. You acknowledge it. You become one with it. To run from your fear is to lose the ability to be in the moment. You're always running from the thing it's chasing you. You have to turn around and look it in the eye and just be with it. And watch what happens when you do that. I've talked about this a lot, but the observation of pain and the observation of fear begin to teach you that there is this thing watching, as opposed to the fear itself. There is this thing that observes it, and that is who you are. You are separate from the fear. You are separate from the pain. You are the awareness of that. And being aware of that is your true nature.
Can I ask one more question? Why did God make it that way, that we have to feel so much, like, that there's this possibility of a horrible, painful, violent death?
Well, Rudy's answer to that was, when you meet God, ask him. I'm not going to speak for God. I have no idea, other than my own sense of it. My own sense of it is that it's not what you think it is, and that when you cross over into the joy of being, every bit of suffering will have made that unbelievably exquisite awakening worth it. I've come in my old age to think that we are that life without pain isn't life. Life without suffering you can't know the joy without the suffering, and that it's all part of the same thing, and that it's worked into the system because it needs to be there, and it needs to be there in its milder form and in its extreme form, and it is part of something very large and very great. And I think either you believe or you experience somewhere that it's all grounded in love, or it's grounded in chaos and non-caring. And that's kind of a belief system you have to find for yourself. And that's really what defines us as people. And this is where belief comes in. Either we believe that somehow this all emerges out of some divine love to be, or out of some abstract chaos that just happened into existence. I don't look around me and see abstract chaos, personally. This doesn't seem to be haphazard. It's too brilliant. So you find a trust, and then you find this one other thing, which I find when I sit and I go really deep, the ground of being is joy itself. And I can't deny it. There it is. It's not even joy in the, I'm so happy joy. Because it's not like that. It's not a vibrational joy that is excitable. It's the opposite. It's pure stillness, and it's a huge yes. So we'll all find out. You know, I'm right or wrong. So will you be. Anyone else?
One of my friends has Alzheimer's and mother died, and so she and my mother's sister died. She's 87 this year. And she said, I've always wanted to write my life story, you know, and all the fear that I've had of losing her. But I just going through that process of asking her questions every day and her listening to her, I found out so many things about her that I never ever knew. It's so beautiful to have that, and you could ask endless questions, you know. But that moment of knowing that at some point she's not going to be able to answer these questions, it's just been beautiful.
It is. I'm telling you, we're here for our story. Mm-hmm. And not to be able to share your story is one of the saddest things around.
Mm-hmm. Well, and I would highly recommend it, you know, for to others, for anyone's.
You know, they publish these books now, which I've given to the older people that I know, which are books that ask you really interesting questions about your life. They ask you things that are, but they don't ask you for the abstract question is, tell me about your childhood. They say, what was the color of the kitchen cabinet in when you were 4 years old? And it goes, there's you're back in your kitchen, and suddenly what that jogs is amazing. The smell of the bacon in the morning, all these things, and the stories emerge from the sensory recollection. And I, you know, you can get those for people, but to give people an opportunity to tell their story, whoever they are, is one of the greatest things you can give anybody. Mm-hmm. And especially the older people. Mm-hmm. They have them to tell. Record them. Mm-hmm. I'm telling you, sitting down, I sat with my mom and dad and just made a recording of their whole, telling me their stories. And it was so beautiful. Because I had my mother tell her own story from childhood, my father tell his story, and then when they got together, they sat and told their stories together. And it was really, really special. And it was special not just for me to have it, but I could see how meaningful it was for them to tell it. Mm-hmm. We all need to share our story. And like this thing I was doing with my friends is a version of that, but it passes on to children and grandchildren and on and on and on. I was my grandmother's favorite grandson for only one reason. Because I asked her about her life. Nobody else cared. But I just wanted to hear. She sang me all the old songs. She told me all the old tales. I endeared myself completely to her for that. And that's, you know, you do that with anybody, truly. You want to make someone happy? Have them tell you their story. Mm-hmm. They will love you. If you're going on a date, do that. You know? Because people love that more than they love anything. So... anyway, enough about the story. Yes?
I know this is very late, but I just have to say this is part of this extraordinary work that we're in. I started doing a writing class at an assisted living place. I never wanted to go there. It's like, please don't send me, right? And I had to do it. And this has been the third week that I've done it. So half of these people have no memory. They can't hear. The stories that they told yesterday, the hearing that appeared, was so beautiful that I just walked out of that place and I thought, this is unspeakable. I didn't want to do it. I did it for the money. Every wrong thing set me there. And I left 8 people saying, can you please come 2 days a week? And I thought, this has to be one of the most beautiful hours I have ever spent in my life. Mm. And here you are talking about this. So I just...
Wonderful.
And part of it was my fear of being around people mm-hmm. who are really dissolving, mm-hmm. but the way they speak is so they can't even feel for words. They just to watch the word kind of come down and they're sharing together and listening to each other. Mm-hmm. And here it is. Amazing.
Mm. Okay. Thank you, guys. Next week, same time, same station.